RN, your world unfolding.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas here on RN and on the web at abc.net.au/radio national. Paul Barclay with you. Tonight, distinguished jurist and leading human rights lawyer Geoffrey Robertson QC. He's giving a broad-ranging and fascinating talk covering the British press, phone hacking, and how the scandal came to light. He also discusses WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's current legal battle, and he looks at three pressing and unresolved issues for international law: the use of drones and targeted killings, terrorists and how they should be dealt with by the law, and what legal mechanism would allow a country to utilise nuclear power yet prevent it from developing nuclear weapons. Geoffrey Robertson QC is an internationally respected lawyer who's shown enormous conviction in his advocacy for human rights around the world. He heads the largest legal chambers in London and is a member of the United Nations Justice Council. He's defended Salman Rushdie and prosecuted General Pinochet. Here now are highlights from Geoffrey Robertson's keynote address to the Queensland Law Society Symposium.
It's great to be back in Queensland, back where I began. I was conceived here on Magnetic Island, the only thing I have in common with Julian Assange. I met my wife here, Kathy Lett, at Brisbane Town Hall. She was sitting next to Joe Bajelke Peterson. It was on a hypothetical kind of Beauty and the Beast. So these defining moments of my life, birth, marriage, I suppose I'll expire in Queensland too, like the ALP, which seems to have won fewer seats in this election than Pauline Hanson did back in 1998. Queensland elections, of course, are famous for the number of deceased voters. Not even the dead came out for the ALP. Perhaps the spirits all voted for Bob Katter. But it's good to be here at a conference of lawyers throughout the common law world. Our problems of maintaining fair trial at a time when justice is always the first public service to suffer financial cutbacks are really very similar. You've been struggling with the Moynihan reforms, no committals, we abolished those in England years ago, reduction in the right to jury trial for offences like the crime of, I quote, bribery to influence electoral conduct. Not much need for that offence last week, I suppose. And there's a crime you've got carrying 2 years imprisonment, which is now triable only before a magistrate, of disclosure of official secrets. I'm not sure what counts as an official secret in Queensland. Recipe for Flo's pumpkin scones, it might have been at one time, but you never know what they're training the dolphins to do down in SeaWorld. Well, in Britain, we haven't cut back on jury trial, but the government came up with a wheeze to make juries more likely to convict, namely to make judges do jury service. This hasn't worked out as planned. The acquittal rate keeps rising. There's some concern that if the jury gets to know that one of their number is a judge, they might give his views more weight. So I was a judge, a recorder, and we all had a letter from the Lord Chief Justice when this change came about, telling us that when called for jury service, don't let them know you're a judge. Well, great. As I discovered, I was called up for jury service. As soon as you get into the jury room, some bright spark says, right, let's go round the room and tell each other what we do. I said I was in grievance management. But my cover was blown as soon as an usher greeted me the next day, good morning, judge. So I was elected foreman, and I confess that I did use my inside knowledge of the Old Bailey on one occasion at 1:45 when we were deadlocked at 10-2. I said, look, you two, if we don't agree on a verdict, we'll be locked up and we'll have to have a jury canteen lunch without alcohol. And brought about a very speedy unanimous verdict. We do have common problems. In America, they don't do criminal law, they do plea bargaining, and the discounts are so massive that the pressure on the innocent to plead guilty can be overwhelming. Just as the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago became alive to that danger, governments in the UK and elsewhere are trying to bring in this rather dangerous system. And everywhere in the common law world, there is the problem of prosecutorial myopia when it comes to the disclosure of exculpatory evidence. It derailed the appeal in the Wood case, the Rennie Revkin's chauffeur convicted of murdering the talkative model in New South Wales recently. It aborted almost the first trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. It's led to a number of miscarriages of justice in the UK. There is only one group that can decide whether evidence is supportive or helpful to the defence, and that is the defence. How often do we hear, "Counsel, you're on a fishing expedition," and how often should the reply come, as every fisherman knows, "You go on a fishing expedition in order to catch fish"? I think the reality is that this has become the most rife cause for miscarriages of justice. The Moynihan Report may help you on that score, and I'll be interested in talking to those who've had some experience of the rules it suggests for police disclosure. The government in the United Kingdom announced this week that trials as well as appeals will now be televised. That will be an interesting reform that might catch on here. I'm inclined to think that it will probably mean that lawyers will be better prepared, judges will be better behaved, and the public will be better informed. There are reforms afoot, too, in the United Kingdom on the selection of judges. Until recently, it was always done on the old boy network. Cap on the shoulder, a few Polonius-like precepts from the Lord Chief Justice, don't get drunk in lodgings. A knighthood to compensate your wife for the drop in your earnings. That's changed. Now every candidate has to apply, go through a selection process, and now it seems, from the latest report, part of that selection process will be public. Questions from a parliamentary committee and some representatives of civil society, perhaps some representatives of the criminal classes, should be entitled to ask judicial candidates how they're going to respond to sentencing reforms. There's no perfect system, but in Europe, where we have 47 countries in the same Euro law system, there are still a number of them that persist with the old telephone justice that was so prevalent in communist times, the telephone call from the party secretary the night before sentence to dictate the sentence. I've been doing some work in Georgia recently where the conviction rate is 99.6%. Georgian policemen, heirs to Stalin and Beria, never make a mistake, or in only in 0.4% of the cases. In Russia, we've seen with the Khodorkovsky case exactly how pressure is put on from Putin's administration to convict. I first struck this when I was acting for the Jazz Society back in the 1980s in Stalinist Czechoslovakia. It's extraordinary that the Jazz Society was the subject of prosecution, but in those days communists greatly suspected jazz. It was music you could talk underneath. I don't like jazz. You keep thinking it will turn into a tune, and it doesn't. But nonetheless, they prosecuted each member of the Jazz Society, and we kicked up enough fuss so the prison sentence that was suggested at 8 years would come down to 2 years. I remember one occasion standing with Vaclav Havel and the in Charles Square on the steps of the court after the president had been sentenced to 2 years, and there was a ragged crowd of supporters outside, and they struck up "We Shall Overcome," a ragged chorus, and I said to Havel, "It's very heartening that we've got this dissident support. And he said, yes, on occasions like this, you always know who are the secret police. They're the ones who know all the words. Well, that's still too true in too many European countries, in too many countries of the world. The promise of impartial and independent justice is a mirage. In Singapore, of course, where they have the highest paid judges in the world, they get over $1 million a year, they have never been known to give a verdict against the government. Except in one case, I'm the advocate who succeeded in the only case that has ever been won against the government. It was in relation to detention orders made on three outspoken Catholic lawyers who... And we brought an action for habeas corpus on the ground, and it was an unanswerable ground that the detention order had been signed not by the minister, as the law required, but by his head of staff. So it was a case that even the Singapore judges on the Court of Appeal could not but give us habeas corpus, and they did. And the families of the detainees were overjoyed. This had never happened in Singapore before, and we went off to the detention centre at Whiteley Bay with the court order to release. The defendants were, or the those who'd been wrongfully detained, were taken out of their cells. The pictures on their walls and their belongings were packed up, and they were put in a car, and they went down the hill through the gates. And the car went through the gates, past their waiting relatives, who expected them to be deposited, round the roundabout, and back up the hill to the detention centre, where they were presented with new detention orders signed by the minister. So even when you win, you lose in those situations. It's quite extraordinary. I had the experience of cross-examining Lee Kuan Yew in front of one of his judges. Whenever the audience laughed, he'd admonish the judge to have them taken out for contempt of court. The judge awarded him particularly high damages. It was a libel action on the grounds that his feelings had been hurt by my cross-examination. The Malaysian Bar Council immediately issued a press release saying this is the first evidence we've had that Mr. Lee Kuan Yew has any feelings. But the struggle for the independence of the judiciary is an international problem, and it's particularly a problem in international courts. I'm on the UN Justice Council. We are responsible for appointing or recommending the appointment of judges for the internal UN system, and it's the only area that we have tried to design in a way that is meritocratic. In other areas, of course, it's always the state nomination. It's the president's son or cousin, sometimes without even legal experience, who gets nominated. The UN is a sadly too nepotistic an organization. But we advertise widely for judges. We advertise in Le Monde and The Economist. We get about 500 replies. We cull them to the most qualified. We take about 40 or 50 to The Hague, and we set them an exam paper, and they have to do a competitive examination. It's quite extraordinary. These are judges of 15 years plus experience in jurisdictions all over the world, and it's amazing how many flunk. They've obviously had their judgments written by their law clerks, and there is nothing like a competitive examination to sort out court appointments. But there are problems. There are, every country is facing problems about securing independent judges. I don't know how long Australia can continue muddling along with appointments made by politicians, appointments that are discussed in cabinet. I'm told the last decision as to Australia's Chief Justice was made between a highly qualified New South Wales candidate and a highly qualified Western Australian candidate after a two-hour debate as to which should it should be in cabinet, at the end of which Prime Minister Rudd, uttering one of his famous expletives, said, to hell with it, we'll take the Western Australian. Well, Both were fine candidates, but this simply isn't a rational way of making judicial appointments. Throughout the world, we are looking for ways of taking politicians out of the equation and selecting people, women particularly, who are free of political ties. Well, the UK and Australia have in common at present a debate over whether and to what extent to regulate the press, and on a more universal scale, how to deal with leaks of government secrets. And as it happens, the fascination over these debates centre upon two great Australians, one aged 80, the other aged 40. Rupert Murdoch is a great Australian, at least in the sense that Attila was a great Hun. And many think that Julian Assange is a great Australian in the sense that Ned Kelly was a great outlaw. So we have the issue of whether to regulate the press. Justice Leveson's inquiry in England, beaten to the punch by Justice Finkelstein's inquiry here, both stem from the same source: the discovery of how journalists and executives of the Murdoch media in the UK had, between 2002 and 2006, conducted industrial-scale espionage, hacking into the mobile phones of celebrities, their agents, their lawyers. They drew the line at hacking into the Prime Minister's phone, but since Caesar's wife is not above tabloid suspicion, they hacked into Cherie Blair's instead. And, of course, they hacked into numerous members of the royal family, not to obtain stories that were anyway in the public interest, but sensational circulation-boosting stories about sex and about grief. They hacked into the phones of murder victims, of bereaved parents whose children had been killed in terrorist attacks. Now, phone hacking is against the law in Britain, the criminal law, and the police finally intercepted a journalist and a hacker who'd hacked into, they were charged only with hacking into royal telephones and that of a football manager and an agent, and there the matter rested. News Limited said, oh, it's only one bad apple. It was end of the story. There was no further hacking. But, of course, it wasn't the end of the story. The truth eventually came out. Not, as is commonly believed, because of the Guardian newspaper, although it played a few years later an important part. It came out because the United Kingdom has a Human Rights Act. Because in Britain now there is a right of privacy. And because several courageous lawyers, solicitors, I have to say, who had their phones hacked mercilessly for their pains, pursued civil action for invasion of privacy. And because judges, armed with this power, first ordered the police to disclose all the evidence that they hadn't bothered to follow up on, partly because they too were in hock to the Murdoch press, and then they ordered News Limited to disclose the relevant emails. Emails that would never have seen the light of day without the Human Rights Act power to sue for breach of privacy, without the judge's power to order disclosure. So the scandal came to light, and only came to light, because the Human Rights Act did what the common law of Britain and Australia had never done, and that is to give a remedy for outrageous invasion of privacy. That's how the scandal was exposed. That's how its victims, the first one was a football manager. He was paid over $1 million by News Limited to hush it up in a settlement that they hoped would end the story. But others came out of the woodwork, Sienna Miller, the actress, and other complainants, and the solicitors used the powers of the court to obtain the evidence and expose the vast extent of the scandal. And, of course, this was all at a time when the Murdoch press in Australia, most notably the Australian newspaper, was running a vitriolic campaign against the very idea of a Human Rights Act here. Oh, it will only give money to lawyers, they said. It'll be a lawyer's picnic. be undemocratic. It will give more power to judges. Well, there's nothing wrong with giving more power to judges if it enables them to do justice. And that is precisely what the Human Rights Act did in this respect in the UK, a power to award damages for soul-destroying invasions of privacy. Well, I'm sure the Australians' campaign against the Human Rights Act here had nothing to do with the problems it was causing Mr. Murdoch and his son in London. Well, the media has to face up to the fact, quite frankly, that if it invades personal privacy illegally and brutally, without any public interest justification, it should compensate the victims as a matter of the decency and morality on which our law is based. We don't have a Human Rights Act here, and it's much more difficult for solicitors to play the part, the courageous part, that they did in Britain in exposing that scandal and winning compensation for their victims. Of course, I'm the first to admit that there are dangers in any broadly defined right to privacy, and I believe it should be very narrowly drawn. We should have a statutory tort that is closely confined. The Murdoch victims, everyone accepts, are being properly compensated. Some cases are far more doubtful. There was Mr. Max Mosley, for example, the son of the wartime Nazi interned in England, who had arranged a spanking session with four prostitutes in a Chelsea basement. One of them went to News of the World, which fixed her up. Her brassiere was a miniature television camera was put clipped on in order to catch all the action. And the front page, the News of the World, duly announced Mosley in Nazi sex orgy. Unfortunately, it wasn't a Nazi sex orgy. It turned out to be good old-fashioned English sex orgy. The News of the World had jumped to the wrong conclusions, apparently, because one of the women moonlighted as a Lufthansa air hostess, although she wasn't related to Hermann Göring. The judge, and these cases are decided by judges, awarded Max Mosley $100,000, in effect, for invasion of privacy, and that was a controversial decision, and I think that future decisions should be made by juries rather than judges. I don't know whether Max would have won before a jury. I suppose it depended on whether they thought he was a deplorable degenerate or not bad for his age. But so there are uncertainties, there are grey areas, but I think when the media chooses to invade intimate personal secrets to the delectation of the public, it has to justify itself on a public interest basis. There are borderline cases. There was the interesting case of Mr. Peck. Mr. Peck was a mentally unstable man who walked into the middle of Birmingham city centre late at night and slashed his wrists, hoping to die. It was an attempt at suicide. He was caught on CCTV camera, and the police were able to see him and save him. A little later, they collaborated in a television programme which wanted to argue the advantages of having CCTV cameras in city centres and wanted to show this. He sued to try to stop them on the basis of invasion of privacy. The Court of Appeal in England decided that there was a public interest justification in showing the programme. Subsequently, the European Court disagreed and decided that his right to privacy prevented the agonies of what he thought would be his final moments being shown on television. I'm not sure that I agree with the European Court on that one, but I think I'd rather live in a society where the law faced up to these issues and decided them, rather than one which gives no protection at all to a basic human dignity. We don't know what the Leveson inquiry will conclude about press self-regulation in Britain. It has become a bit of a joke, this idea that newspapers can regulate themselves. They had a press council which condemned the Sun newspaper another of Mr. Murdoch's tabloids, very vigorously for showing secret paparazzi pictures taken of Princess Diana when she was pregnant on a Caribbean beach. And after the very day after this swinging condemnation came down, the newspaper republished all the photographs under the headline, "This is what the row's all about, folks." So self-regulation simply hasn't worked. The Finkelstein report suggests the Media Council, backed by statutory powers, 10 men and 10 women. It says, chaired by an ex-judge. This seems to me a rather unwieldy proposition that has some dangers for freedom of speech, particularly because it won't have the right to give compensation for invasion of privacy. It will only have the power to order apologies. And that never seems to me to be a sensible power for a court or any organization to have. The editor of Private Eye was once asked whether there were any falsehoods ever published in Private Eye, and he said, yes, only the apologies. It does strike me as inappropriate that there should be any orders on newspapers to apologize where they don't believe in it, which apologies that are not sincere. But what essentially the victims of inaccuracies and vitriolic attacks want is a correction, a speedy correction. What they want is the right to reply to the attack. And that is an area where a press ombudsperson, in South Africa they call them ombuds, to avoid the sexist phrase of ombudsman. But whatever you call the person, it seems to me that an independent adjudication requiring speedy corrections, requiring rights of reply, and a limited right to sue when the press invades privacy without public interest justification may be the way forward. Always defending and protecting the classic role of the press.
You're listening to Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. Tonight's speaker is leading human rights lawyer Geoffrey Robertson QC. Next up, he considers the case of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Geoffrey Robertson is actively involved in the matter, offering legal advice to Julian Assange.
Well, Julian Assange, the young man from Magnetic Island, he invented might be termed an electronic dead letterbox, where sources could send him secret documents in complete confidence that they'd remain anonymous because even he couldn't find out who they were. There'd be no problem with protecting his source. They could waterboard him as long as they liked, and he simply wouldn't know. All he did was to check for the authenticity of the documents, and WikiLeaks, as far as I know, has never published an inauthentic document. So Assange became a kind of latter-day Johnny Appleseed, scattering government information or secret information far and wide, watching it inspire revolutions and expose politicians and policemen, inspire policy debates, and it's very difficult to read a long article in a newspaper about current affairs today without seeing a reference to a WikiLeaks cable as part of the background. So, reminding, I began in 2007 by exposing the massive corruption in Daniel Arap Moi's government. And then he published documents exposing malpractices in the Church of Scientology, exposing tax evasion in Cayman Island banks, the details of a nuclear accident in Iran, price gouging by defense contractors in Iraq. All of these documents of immediate and obvious public interest. Then last year, in quick, we had the Bradley Manning documents beginning in 2010. You remember the what he called collateral murder, even though it was really collateral manslaughter, the killing of two Reuters journalists and several children from an American helicopter. Then we had, that was certainly a war crime, or at least a matter that required investigation and had been hushed up by the American authorities. Then the Afghan war logs that showed far higher level of civilian casualties than had ever been admitted. And then Iraq Gate, the 400,000 field reports, that really was a living history of how that war was fought, a treasure trove for future historians writing about the war on the ground. Then there was still no protest from the American government at this point, but there was an interesting fact emerged by this time that some countries were so disturbed by this phenomenon that they blocked all WikiLeaks-related websites and threatened to jail any of their citizens caught sending material to WikiLeaks. Those countries were China, Syria, North Korea, Russia, Thailand, and Zimbabwe, the real enemies of freedom. But then, in December of 2010, we had Cablegate and then the burst of hysteria from the United States. Cablegate was the release, mediated through The Guardian and The New York Times, of the American diplomatic cables. And that caused an enormous fuss. We had Joe Biden, Mike Huckabee, accused Assange of being a terrorist, demanded he was a high-tech terrorist, according to Joe Biden. Rush Limbaugh yearned, I quote, for Julian Assange to die of lead poisoning from a bullet in the brain. Sarah Palin, shooting as ever from the lip, said, I quote, he should be hunted down like bin Laden, which would, I suppose, give him 9 more years of freedom. But even today, when I go and see him up in Norfolk, where he's under house arrest or mansion house arrest, I have to keep a wary eye open for Navy SEALs. I get quite a few death threats, actually, for acting for him, although since most of them come on email, I don't take them very seriously. But there have been some sober voices. Robert Gates, the Defense Secretary, said, well, it's an embarrassment, but no long-term damage. And Hillary Clinton, told by the New York Times of the impending publication, contacted foreign governments to tell them that they were coming. And they said to her, don't worry, you should see what we say about you. And so the people of Tunis and Egypt discovered facts about corruption that fueled the Arab Spring. People in 90 countries and received information about misfeasance in their public life. We heard about the U.S. plans to bug diplomats at the United Nations in breach of the Vienna Convention, about the demands by Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states that U.S. should attack Iran to stop its nuclear weapons program. And I think the greatest surprise of all, it always seems to me, is that it showed that U.S. diplomacy was reasonably principled and reasonably pragmatic. Quite insightful, in fact. And President Putin at one point attacked Assange as a CIA agent. He said he was spreading a US view of the world. But America was upset. Its pride was wounded by this pesky Australian. It couldn't, because of the First Amendment, of course, attack the New York Times. But it has done three things, each of them, I think, a betrayal of the principles of the Founding Fathers, of James Madison and so on. First of all, it arrested Bradley Manning and kept him in solitary confinement, naked, without blankets or pillow, for 8 months. And charged him with an offense under the Espionage Act, carrying the death sentence, in the hope that he would implicate Assange and say that he was groomed and incited to make the revelations. He's refused to do that, and his treatment for those initial 8 months was outrageous. Secondly, it put the frighteners on domain name servers in America, WikiLeaks.org. Amazon gave in and refused to host the site, so it moved to Iceland and Sweden. And still, it's put pressure on PayPal, MasterCard, and Visa, stopping them receiving donations. You can buy Nazi uniforms, you can buy Ku Klux Klan uniforms with your Visa card, but you can't donate to WikiLeaks. Well, on what basis was this attack? It was said loudly and repeatedly, that Assange would have blood on his hands, that the sources that were exposed would be killed in reprisal. Well, the proof of the pudding, 15 months, 18 months on, no physical harm to a single source. A few embarrassing moments, a few ambassadors withdrawn, but no reprisals. And of course, there's a very good reason for this, because none of the WikiLeaks cables were top secret. They were secret, but unless they are classified as top secret, it meant that the sender had no fear that any source named would suffer reprisals. So it was wrong to suggest that these cables were of a kind that which might lead to reprisals. 2.5 million Americans had access to documents that were classified, given this level of classification. But I think there's a general point of principle here, and it's a principle that should operate in respect of all government secrecy laws. It is that governments have a duty, the prime duty, to protect their own secrets. It is only when journalists obtain documents through bribery, through corrupt relationships with the document holder, that the law should step in. If these secrets go absent, by all means, governments are entitled to prosecute the leaker. They're not entitled to prosecute the publishers of that leaked information unless the publisher has done something to induce it by payment of money or by other corrupt circumstance. We can all envisage situations where leaks are wrong, lists of police informants, or the draft of a budget speech, and so on. But the principle, of course, is that keepers of those genuine secrets have the duty to keep them, and prosecution can and in some cases should follow. But there must be, in all cases, a sensible classification policy that defines a particular class of information as secret. I suppose the real development that has come about that has made so many laws unenforceable, that there is now, through electronic means of communication, a situation where people can get access to material, do talk to each other. Vaclav Havel described the power of the powerless, and we're seeing it in so many respects. In Adidas and Nike use child labor. People tweet, they go on Facebook, they say to each other, let's not buy Adidas, let's not buy Nike. There was the extraordinary case of the Domino's pizza man who was seen on a secret film putting the cheese up his nose and then on the pizza. And the film went viral on the internet. 2 days later, 20% was knocked off the share price of Domino's pizzas. This is the power of the powerless. This is what this is the power of ordinary people, as lawyers rather condescendingly describe people who aren't lawyers, who have the opportunity to influence events. And there may, of course, be But what we are finding is what's been described as digital suffrage. You can vote with a click. Well, Google is still blocked in 25 countries. You can't get YouTube in Turkey, apparently because there was something posted which suggested that Ataturk was gay, and they brought down the whole business. But 2 billion people are now interconnected. 21% of global growth is attributed to ideas and education that is picked up from the internet. So we are in a new world. The WikiLeaks phenomenon is here to stay. Imitation, the most sincere form of flattery. The Wall Street Journal has developed its own alternative to WikiLeaks, something it calls Safe House, and guarantees anonymity for information that comes to it in the same way as Julian Assange has received his information. So, in that sense, he has been a pioneer of a form of publishing that has produced a degree of enlightenment. He's been under house arrest for 450 days. His case will soon be decided by the Supreme Court. It is, ironically, a case which depends on whether European countries are entitled to have their prosecutors sit in the role of judges and issue arrest warrants for people in other countries. It's an important point of principle, and the Supreme Court will be deciding it in May. So the Assange saga has a long way to run.
On RN, I'm Paul Barclay. This is Big Ideas, and tonight we're in Brisbane for Geoffrey Robertson QC's recent keynote address to the Queensland Law Society. To conclude his talk, Geoffrey Robertson considers three pressing issues that he feels international law urgently needs to address.
Well, finally, there are three great issues that international law has yet to solve. I'll mention them briefly. First is drone killings. The war on terror is a rhetorical phrase, actually. You can't go to war on a common noun. But the US, not just the Bush administration, increasingly the Obama administration, which has invoked the law of war to justify the targeted killing, especially by drones, of those it identifies as enemy leaders and soldiers in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the Yemen. The present US Solicitor General says that the right of self-defense in war entitles America to liquidate, to execute summarily without trial, those it believes are terrorists or Taliban. And this war law paradigm was developed in declared war between great states. It provides no basis for the killings in Yemen and Pakistan. Reports at the end of the last year suggest that there have been over 1,000 targeted killings, 385 civilian deaths, 168 of them children. Israel, too, has its drones over Gaza, 387 deaths, 234 members of Hamas, and 153 civilians who got in the way. Russia has its own targeted killings in Chechnya. It doesn't produce statistics. The law has not caught up with the problems of asymmetrical warfare. The use of drones, which are surveillance craft armed with Hellfire missiles and laser-guided bombs flown by operators 12,000 miles away. Decapitation strikes, the CIA calls them, but there are so many civilians who are being killed in Pakistan, killed at funerals, killed at weddings. Yes, many terrorists have indeed been killed, but 20% of the casualties are now estimated to be innocent civilian victims. And, of course, the parable of the dragon's teeth is always with us when these killings take place. Well, the problem is they're entirely outside the law. They're done by the CIA, not by the US Army. When they killed an American citizen, Al-Awaki, his name was, his family brought judicial review proceedings of this secret CIA policy. The court said the father didn't have standing. Well, if a father doesn't have standing to challenge the killing of his son, who does? It's a secret execution list with hundreds of names on it. The Israeli Supreme Court has, I think, quite courageously considered this new form of execution and talked about how you've got to limit it to dedicated terrorists, how it can't be operated when they're a danger to civilians. But, of course, that danger is always present in the crammed living quarters of Gaza City, teeming with people. There's no easy solution, and the battlefield utility of drone technology, which is currently available to 40 different nations, it's going to be widely used in future conflicts and by states less scrupulous than America and Israel. Drones are becoming more compact. There are plans for bird or insect-sized drones that will be capable of crawling inside homes and squatting on window ledges to listen and send kill messages to their bigger brethren. That's without the need for any pilot in Nevada to press a button. There is urgent need, as Philip Alston, a voice in the wilderness, as the UN rapporteur, another Australian international lawyer, keeps saying. We need, first of all, to have drone transparency on drone killings. The target list must be made public. The criteria for listing an individual is susceptible to execution, and there must be proper judicial review to decide whether they are active terrorists or combatants who belong on the list. The rules of engagement must exclude any killing if civilians are likely to be present, the Israeli Supreme Court principle. There must be a rule that drone attacks cannot be used when there's any alternative non-lethal solution, where capture is possible, where surrender is on the cards. And finally, I believe there should be a rule that drone killing should not be used where the individual suspect is not engaged in a way that is reasonably related to combat, where they are at a funeral or at a wedding, the two cases in Pakistan where most civilians have been killed. That's one problem. The second problem is how do you try those terrorist leaders you do capture? This is going to crystallize in a few months' time in the trial of the century. The trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, much waterboarded KSM, to be distinguished from DSK, which was the non-trial of the century. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed boasts that he's the mastermind of 9/11, and the US prosecutors have taken him at his word. The Obama administration wanted him to stand trial by jury in New York. The Republicans made a terrible outcry. The Pentagon was opposed. They're opposed to jury trial, not because the jury might be prejudiced, but they're opposed because the New York jury might acquit. They don't trust jury service. So we have now the extraordinary situation that the Attorney General of the United States has been forced to retract, forced to have him tried before a military commission, a jury of soldiers trying their enemy, a judge advocate employed by the Defense Department sitting as judge. And this will not be an independent and impartial tribunal. It is, as George Clemenceau once said, military justice is to justice as military music is to music. It simply is not a solution. The answer, of course,
The alternative would be an international court trial. That's something that America wouldn't allow, but at least a trial between three or five judges, producing a reasoned decision, a decision that can convince the Arab street. Because the irony is that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed wants to be convicted. He can't wait to plead guilty. Every hearing, he insists that he's guilty because the America, with its obsessional clinging to the death penalty, is giving this man what he wants more than anything else in the world, namely to die in a jihad, to be cut down by an American army firing squad. That will be the penalty. He'll be shot, or even if he's lethally injected, he gets, in his own belief system, a fast track to paradise. America is out to give this man what it wants, but it will not, or what he wants, but it will not be justice. How much better if he's denied what he wants, if he lives out probably his greatest fear, to have to live out the rest of his life on a prison farm in upstate New York. Sadly, next year, America will grant him his wish. And finally, let me end with the greatest challenge of all, and that is for international law to develop a principle of dealing with those countries which are entitled to develop nuclear technology to enrich uranium up to a point at which it has a dual use, which it can be used for nuclear power, or which it can be used for the greatest destroyer of all, the nuclear bomb. This is, we have an incoherent decision from the International Court of Justice back in 1996. It's time for another case to be brought, developing a law which can decide which countries are entitled to develop, to enrich uranium up to that point. The countries that can must be those countries which whose governments have not committed crimes against humanity, or which have been dealt or with those crimes, to give nuclear power to mullahs without mercy, mullahs who have avoided prosecution for the worst crime, unpunished crime, in 1988 when the government of Iran decided to kill all its political prisoners, worse than the death marches at the end of the Second World War, worse than Srebrenica. Tens of thousands of political prisoners were declared Moharib, enemies of God, were hung from cranes, hung from six at a time from prison auditorium. That crime has never been dealt with, and it is a challenge for international lawyers to find a law that will stop, that will in fact draw the line between those governments that can develop nuclear power up to this crucial point and those which cannot. That is a challenge. Let's hope we rise to it before it's too late. Thank you all.
Geoffrey Robertson QC, the keynote speaker at the Queensland Law Society Symposium, which was held recently in Brisbane. Thanks to Damien Carrick from RN's Law Report, which you can hear Tuesday evenings at 5:30. Also to Geoffrey Robertson and the Queensland Law Society.